I just wanted to share with you some thoughts about an intergenerational school, which Elise mentioned is in Cleveland, and that my wife, who's a developmental psychologist and should be listed on this slide, and I started 13 years ago. I think it illustrates many of the ideas that we've heard in the session this afternoon coming together in one educational environment and represents some of the dynamics of the conference that was mentioned and that we held in New York around bringing the worlds of kids, the worlds of and advocates for kids and elders and the environment together. There is another name that should be on this slide, and that's Danny George, who's in the back there, who has done studies on the impact of the elders, particularly elders with dementia, participating in this school for his PhD thesis in anthropology. And I'd like to just single out Marie Janet again, because not only did she do the work in the New York conference, but one of the things that came out of that conference is we're now in conversation about an intergenerational school in Minneapolis that Maria has had in the back of her mind for some time and that may come forward. So this is all about creating connections, as Kathy just said. I have disclosures to disclose either. I'm a scientist, a neuroscientist, and a geriatric neurologist, but I also am very much interested in words and stories. And a couple of words that I wanted to put on the table really emanate from some of the work that Ted's been pioneering, which is to make sure that we get our health models and the words we use to characterize them broad enough. By the way, I'm a big believer in Dwight Eisenhower's quote that sometimes if you've got problems, and for example, our school addresses the fact that we have huge problems in public education, huge problems in our healthcare system. So if we think about putting a health clinic into a school, which of course those of you that come to APHA know is a theme in this in one of the sections of APHA, maybe we can solve the problem by making it bigger by addressing the challenges of both those systems. Sometimes doctors, and I am one, try to make the medical model broader by using the word biopsychosocial. My own sense, though, is that doctors are far too enamored with reductionistic medicine, with genes, and I am an Alzheimer's, or somebody who used to think Alzheimer's was a useful concept. I now think it's not. So, but in the Alzheimer's field, which is driving a lot of the concern about the future of aging in our country, it's all about a kind of a molecular approach. If we don't get an evolutionary perspective, an ecological perspective, so I go around telling doctors they've got the bio wrong. The other word that I got a little endorsement from one of our collaborators in Toronto, Michael Fullen, where we're doing systems change work around intergenerationality in the Toronto, Ontario provincial public schools, is the word intergenerativity. That is to say, we need to look in society to be innovative at bringing sources of positive generativity. And I like the way Elise introduced my talk. Hopefully, some positivity that can countervail the challenges that we're all facing in the world. That somehow you can enhance our resilience and sustainability by looking at conversations between different areas of innovation and integrating them. And that is what we hope to be doing in the school that I'm now going to tell you about. The eco-psychosocial model of health, which we're embracing in developing the health practice in the school. So I'm really telling you about the school, which has been doing health really for its 13 years, but we're now trying to build a primary care and public health practice into the school more formally. Has many of the features of the kind of World Health Organization definition of health. It's more than just getting rid of diseases. I don't like to do organ-specific health, but to the extent that the brain is a organ, one of the principal organs of learning, we focus on this whole notion of bringing brain health into our health practice. It's not just a brain in isolation, though, because the main thing you can do, as Ted illustrated, the huge wonder of taking on prevention and brain health in this broad way is it's the same things that you do for almost all the brain diseases and many body illnesses as well. This is why it's so important to take this broader perspective. It's just not a perspective that the pharmaceutical industry likes us to have, for example. And we want in this model not only to be focused on individual health, but on public and community health, as you'll see as we integrate this. And Kathy mentioned the word, it needs to be systems oriented. How do we help folks, be they kids or elders, appreciate with the humility that it needs a sense of the complex interrelationships between issues that we're dealing with in our current times. And so the name of the practice, Interwell, highlights concepts like how do we create collective wisdom? How do we take advantage of the intergenerational conversation space where the elders and the kids interact on a daily basis to create a knowledge which goes beyond just rote learning, No Child Left Behind or whatever, and takes us into a space where we're actually thinking about that seven-generation perspective, the words we learn from our indigenous peoples, the long-term view. And how do we use that to enhance the quality of life of the participants in our practice and in our community? And again, just to resonate with what Kathy said, this is just one illustration of the fine work that many people are doing around the country and around the world to bring these intergenerational ideas into community, not just schools. This is the only article I ever wrote to try to have my impact factor was to be hospital administrators. Taking brain health to a deeper and broader level, what does that mean? It means, why do you want to stay alive? Why do you want to keep a functioning brain going? And that is to have a sense of purpose in your life. That is the depth part of the metaphor. And often, as you get older, the best way to manifest individual purpose is in community, helping other people. And so that's the whole spirit of our brain health perspective. It's not just the Mediterranean diet. It's not just the air quality. It's not just exercise. All of those things are important. But why do you want to put those all together? And that's what we're trying to have emerge out of the school. Now, the school is 13 years old, as I said. It's located in an old Merchant Marine hospital in Cleveland, Ohio, in that anchor-shaped building, which you may not be able to see, but it is. And it opens its doors in the year 2000. And it's an urban school. It's a public school. It's a free school. It's a charter school. My wife and her staff managed to get better results for the kids, rated excellent, or higher. How can you be higher than excellent in the rating systems? You could be excellent with distinction. There are ceiling effects that we're beginning to find, but we've had that rating because our kids do well on the standardized test scores, and these are kids that otherwise would be, and I hate to say it, failing metropolitan school district. And we are actively, by the way, as a charter school, operating in Ohio to help the whole public school system transform itself. And so we're not competing. We're trying to complement what we want to do with the larger system. It has been internationally and nationally recognized. We have replication programs in conversation and one ongoing in Tokyo. The mission was to create a school around lifelong learning and spirited citizenship. The vision was to transform Cleveland, that's to say, to try to impact the communities in the way that Kathy described, but then have an impact outside our own community, perhaps in Minneapolis, perhaps in Tokyo, perhaps in Finland, and in Toronto where we're working. The main principles of the educational model are that learning is a lifelong developmental process, which sounds silly to say. It seems to be self-evident. On the other hand, our school systems are built around putting people of certain chronological ages into classroom spaces, and then, of course, having failure associated with not moving along at the normal speeds with your colleagues. So we don't use grades. We use a developmental curriculum with multi-age classes. Progress is based on actually learning certain skill sets, based on mastery. And it is a holistic language, so that knowledge is socially constructed. We are helping each other. That's why I unembarrassingly use the word collective wisdom. We really need to work together because everybody has a little bit of wisdom, and we need to figure out how to magnify that by being in community together. The developmental stages are, I won't go into them in any detail, but just to make the point that we have a problem with the bureaucracy because they want to put people into grade levels, and we keep trying to resist that. We call them clusters all the way from emerging through the senior capstone project, where that our seniors, who are eighth graders, quote unquote, go out into the community and do a capstone project. We believe in values, honoring the web of life, celebrating diversity, honoring elders, a work ethic. So we actually have a report card, which not only grades quote-unquote folks on their academic performance, but also in their manifestation of these values that emerge in community. We are working towards, from that K-8 public school in the orange, increasing circles of influence. Like lime green in the middle is called dissemination, and beyond at the end we've got the intergenerational learning community as the broader conception of what we hope to accomplish. So there they are, lifelong learners and spirited citizens. I want to bring attention, though, to the issues that we've been talking about in this session, which is our responsibility for not only our own fellow human beings and the social community, but the natural community as well. So this is the Doan Brook, which runs a fairly short distance from our school down Shaker Heights. That's why they call them the Heights. There aren't too many Heights in Ohio, but we have a few. And that brook runs out of the Shaker Nature Center down into Lake Erie. And those are undergraduates in the second year we had the school from what was then called Aquacore, helping our kids appreciate their natural watershed. We have a variety of other programs which are highlighting now gardening. So these are a bunch of business students that we managed to get dig in the dirt, and they had a great time. They did a wonderful job with our environmental educator, Brett Joseph, constructing what we call an edible forest garden. That's a particular model of permaculture, driving a garden towards food production, as you can illustrate. And so we believe that this garden becomes a highlight for our individual and our public health initiatives. I say as a neurologist that I'm moving my practice from a hospital to a garden. And we also do a lot of qualitative research, and so there's a bench over there. So I say, people, I'm going back to being a bench researcher, which is not the usual bench research that people imagine when you're talking about that. We have a community engagement with the university as well as our own students to produce a garden. And this is lying. This is real. There are actually food-producing plants here, but we have not been able to quite yield the harvest. But that's shown in this slide. But all of that food is from within 1 hour of Cleveland, not the 2,000 miles that our average piece of food travels. So we are celebrating local foods. And we're celebrating local foods as a part of our health program because and we are all familiar with the challenges that these urban city kids have getting access to healthy food because of the food deserts. So this is an eye-opener in terms of their participation in growing their own food and appreciating the health benefits for them. But it's also a food safety issue. It's also an issue of how we can create communities that can depend less on the importation of food associated with the high carbon costs of that importation. So that is the vision of how we create the garden as a focal point for our intergenerational conversations about what it means to be healthy individually and as a community. I want to use this. It's been shown to you before. This is both the report that Ted, Maria, Elise, and others were involved in, Healthy Threats to Healthy Aging, with a closer look at Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. I am a geriatric neurologist. I work with folks with Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. And I think the conference that we held that highlighted the principles in that report has already been featured. We were very pleased that the intergenerational school could be a small-scale participant, but it was one of our photographs that illustrated the kinds of conversations that that our elders have. You can't see that slide, and I wasn't planning to do that, but basically you can see a young African-American girl and a woman. They're looking at a sports medal that the girl won, and we do a lot of storytelling in that way, where people either read books or share stories from their own lives. And we do work with people with dementia in the school, because we find that people with so-called Alzheimer's don't really have one condition. It's not going to be fixed by some kind of amyloid vaccine that we're spending tens of billions of dollars on. It's going to be fixed, if you want to call it that, by embracing the opportunities for people with memory challenges to participate in community and to keep their brain health going and to create a sense of legacy by interacting with kids. I'll end with one story, which is the legacy of the Clark Freeway Fighters. This is a reflection from the Doan Brook. And these were elders who in 1962 prevented a corrupt politician in Cuyahoga County from putting a highway right through the middle of Shaker Heights, and it would have decimated the watershed as well. Actually, we can blame Dwight Eisenhower on that because it was part of the urge we had in the 1960s to build interstate freeways through everything, including communities like Shaker Heights. But people like Kay Fuller banded together with her neighbors and essentially, much to their own surprise, became environmental activists and well known for the fact that they had this freeway stopped and it never went through. And as a result of that, our kids can go to the Nature Center and learn in ways that they wouldn't had that been unsuccessful. So this is an issue of legacy. It's an issue of our kids interviewing these elders and developing a sense of collective responsibility for the watershed and the nature that their community has. Mrs. Fuller, and by the way, all these photographs are used with permission, has a mild memory problem. So she would be challenged to tell you what she had had for breakfast, but she would be very able to celebrate her enthusiasm for her community and the legacy that she's passing on to the kids. Danny and the group of us have published a number of these stories of these elders, some of whom had dementia, some of whom did not. Danny creatively called this Occupy Nature Passing Activism Across the Generations. And we just had the Eisner Foundation. We were a finalist for their best practices in intergenerational learning, and we were a finalist also for Kathy Sykes' Rachel Carson Award some years ago, so we love winning prizes, particularly from nice people like Kathy and the EPA. That's right. But here we see Kay and another of the ladies with mild memory problems sharing with the kids photographs of themselves in the book that I just showed you. So what we're trying to do now, and this is my last slide, is to build a practice in the school. I think I try to convince you we're doing health, we're educating about health. We've had the nursing students from our nursing school at Case Western Reserve there since the very beginning of the school doing service learning. But more than that, we now want to develop a practice in the school. So we're working with the National Assembly of School-Based Healthcare, which didn't have a booth this year, but they're usually quite present here at APHA. And this is a somewhat novel practice, partly because it's in an intergenerational school, and that by itself makes it not unusual, since there aren't very many of those. Partly because we're reaching out in a very, dare I say, transdisciplinary way to the nursing school, because every school is required to have some kind of school nursing presence, which is relatively underdeveloped in many schools. But we want to make this a nursing practice because I think nurses get it more than doctors do in terms of holistic connections between aspects of health education and even community health. Not the doctors that are at APHA, but the doctors I usually run into in the professional groups I'm part of. We want it very much to be a matter of making the problem bigger. If the kids are learning about health-related issues in the school already, and then they go visit the doctor, and the doctor or the nurse, they happen to be nearby, the opportunities to reinforce the messages back and forth are, I think, enormous. My wife, who's the principal of our school, as I mentioned earlier, has, despite the best efforts, has very great difficulties connecting with a healthcare establishment. If it's a kid, and there's ADHD meds, or a kid with their asthma, it just doesn't work. They're not connected, and they should be, and I think that will lead to better outcomes if we can do that. I am not a primary care physician, although I sometimes say if I were reincarnated, I would like to come back as one. I'm a geriatric neurologist who specialized in what I used to call Alzheimer's disease, so I need to get my family medicine colleagues, and the family medicine department at Case just renamed themselves to Family Medicine and Community Health, which is a good sign. But because my chairman is a neurologist, I want to emphasize brain health, and I think it is it does make sense, as I said in the very beginning, that in an educational institution you can help kids not understand exactly how their brains work, because even neuroscientists don't know that really, but at least understand enough about taking care of their brain so that they can be good learners and contribute to their communities. And more, we're working on models of health coaching, of chronic disease self-management, because the healthcare system of the future needs to start young with kindergartners and first graders to say, look, nurses and doctors can help you, but the person principally responsible for your health is yourself. And so it really does empower individuals in that way. And as I said before, and I think most importantly, when I came back from Brazil, I told some of my academic colleagues, I've come back as a shaman. And I mean that in two senses. One is shamans know the power of stories to create health. And I'm a big believer in narrative medicine, which is a movement that's unfolding in medicine out of Columbia, out of Rachel Remen's work here, out of the University of California, San Francisco, and Commonweal. But it's stories that we tell about our individual health, which will make us have that sense of cohesiveness that is basically a fundamental part of health. But the shaman who knows how that the stories of individuals also connect to the stories of community. You really cannot do individual and community health in isolation, despite the fact that American medicine is separated medicine in the way that I'm very pleased to be back at the American Public Health Association, because I always feel like you guys are in sync with the message that we're trying to emanate here out of our practice. So thank you.
It's really extraordinary to hear this embodiment of what we're really trying to do here, and have put health in the center and really see the connections and relationships between everything in our environment is really what we're trying to get out, and I suspect you all are on the same path. So we're delighted to have all of our speakers come back up. We have just a few minutes. We tried to have longer Q&A session, but you know, they're all great presentations. So if anyone has any questions, we have about 5 minutes. I'd be happy to anyone come up to the mic, because there are no other roaming mics. So please. When you say our, I mean California?
No, I'm talking about the U.S.
Oh, okay.
Transportation.
Oh, that one.
All the money that we use is called enhancement funds for bicycles and pedestrian trails. And I would like to bring everybody's attention to that. We need to change that.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions, comments? You all are satiated. Yes, please.
My question for Dr. Whitehouse, I am really interested in schooling. I live in St. Louis, and we also have a failing school system, and it's really not an environmental question, but more of a, there's one school in St. Louis that's very well, the lottery-based system, so they get kids into the school, but they have a lot of
So our questioner is from St. Louis, where they have some challenge public schools, and is asking about parental engagement and how we enroll kids. So by having an intergenerational school, you emphasize the notion that everybody is learning all the time, and so that engages parents in that process as well. So I would say we have not, you know, originally we thought maybe we should do something like a GED or connect with a community college. Our adult learning programs are really just more experiential and service-oriented. So we haven't really specifically addressed the parents, but we have high attendance rates both at the kids and almost always 100% at the parent-teacher conferences, which is one measure of the engagement of the parents in the school. This is a charter school, so we are accept all comers. Now, we have a lottery because we get more applicants than we have. But the demographics of our kids, about 75% Title I poverty level, are the same as in the Cleveland Metropolitan School District. So when my wife and her staff gets outstanding performance, it's undoubtedly because the parents find us. So I think the parents who come to our school, I can't say it's a, you know, it's not a randomized study. It's demographically the same. But we celebrate the parents being engaged in a rich way. The big difference with charter schools is we don't have teachers' unions. And that gets into this whole issue of professionalism versus parental engagement. But I will tell you that the levy in Cleveland has the support of the teachers' union and the high-performing charter schools, and the teachers' union is supporting 1 mil of that levy going towards charter schools. So stay tuned in Cleveland to see if we can actually break this, unfortunately, unhealthy, you know, conflict between innovative charter schools and innovative public, regular public schools, because we're all about improving public education, in my view. And parents are key.
Any last burning question or comment, please? All right, you've been a wonderful audience. Thank you to all of our panelists. Fantastic work.